Radio.
War by Other Mean Girls. A talk by Dr. Matthew Tan.
What I'm planning to do today in this paper is to explore the idea of total war in contemporary times, where the front line has collapsed into the home front. In the First World War, this collapse between the front line and the home front was epitomized by a story where children became part of a conquer collection campaign so as to provide an alternative supply of acetone for the war effort. The collapse of the home front to the front line that this story represents is an important point because it's not simply a wartime phenomenon. Indeed, another subtler kind of total war has continued to this day, which has normalized total war by banalizing it. I would like to draw your attention to the Columbine High School shooting of 1999 and its aftermath. In the post-mortem of the incident, fingers were pointed to the shooter's penchant for an icon of pop culture, video games. Video games like the Grand Theft Auto series. Now, in focusing on whether the violence depicted in video games caused the violence in the classrooms, one thing that was missed was the series of processes that made such artifacts of pop culture available and acceptable in the first place. They are just as much a part of pop culture as the game itself. They are just as much a part of pop culture as the show, the shirt. And it is these processes in pop culture that I think represent the real banalization of violence, where the collapse of the front line into the home front is taking place. It is a process where each and every one of us has become privy to the nurturing of a soil whereby the step from peacetime to wartime has become so small as to become virtually non-existent. What I wish to do today is to draw attention to Daniel M. Bell's recent book, The Economy of Desire, which provides an important contribution to the discussion on René Girard's mimetic violence by looking at the mechanics whereby the totalization of war operates within contemporary social fabrics. In particular, the book is important in identifying how pop culture, as an offspring of consumer capitalism, acts as the agent to the totalization of mimetic violence. Through Bell's book, I seek to identify the forms of relations created by consumer capitalism as the new configuration of the battlefield. I further wish to show how World War I's collapse of the home front into the front line has become inverted in contemporary times. Rather than conscripting the home front into the front line, in a military confrontation, the home front has now become the front line, and all social relations have now, by default, adopted a logic that parallels that of military confrontation. Thus, even with no shots being fired, the thread of bellicosity continues to weave its way into the very fibers of the entire social fabric. The value of this analysis, I believe, is to provide a practical supplement to Girardian analysis that where networks of victimage continue at the minutiae of domestic life. In so doing, I wish to flesh out the inversion of the Clausewitzian maxim. War is no longer politics by other means, but politics has become war by other means. But going beyond that, I think it would be possible to say that through pop culture, life itself has now become war by other means. The analysis of pop cultures being encoded by the logic of total war begins with an analysis of the relationship between desire and the social fabric. Now, on this score, Bell's chapter in the book entitled Capitalist Desire is very instructive because it highlights this link with reference to the work of Gilles Deleuze and Michel Foucault. Bell understands desire to operate within the social fabric via what he regards as structures of governance, which discipline and channel desire into particular institutional forms. Capitalism is relevant in this context, argues Bell, because it is not so much a completely novel event, but it is a highly important episode in the reconfiguration of relations between the sovereign and the social fabric. This in turn becomes highly important in the way war becomes normalized within the social fabric. Bell sets the stage for our story of the popularization of war by talking about capitalism's part in a larger story of the dispersal of desire as it escapes the control of the territorial sovereign. And the sovereign's relationship to economic flows forms the backbone of this narrative. Bell refers to a Deleuzian maxim with regards to desire, which is laid out in his book A Thousand Plateaus, co-authored with Felix Guattari. For Deleuze, desire is not only the most fundamental social-political force, desire is also something that constantly seeks to escape its confines and move beyond any attempts to discipline it. Deleuze examines this with reference to three archetypical assemblages of desire, economy, and state, namely the archaic state, the diverse state, and the capitalist state. The archaic state represents this assemblage that manifests the state's desire to control and supervise all economic activity within its domain by breaking up, this is an important part, the breaking up of traditional economic ties bound by kinship and familial ties within an agricultural economic landscape. What this breakup constitutes is the first step of what Deleuze calls the deterritorialization of desire, which the sovereign then tries to exert control over by making itself the sole owner of the means of production, which is then becomes a re-territorialization of desire. For Deleuze, this becomes increasingly untenable, however, as the economy complexifies. Another deterritorialization emerges as soon as the re-territorialization takes place. It emerges as increasingly feudal modes of economic arrangement challenge the monopoly of the sovereign's control over the means of production. And eventually, after a series of mutations, with the advent of capitalism, capitalism itself becomes the sole axiom that arranges everything within the social fabric. So what happens to the sovereign? It evolves from then being an economic controller in the archaic state into becoming a handmaiden of an economic axiomatic. And also becomes a highly proactive player. The state becomes a highly proactive player infusing the social fabric with the economic. In Bell's words, the sovereign, quote, aggressively encourages and advocates the extension of economic reason into every fiber and cell of human life, unquote. Under these conditions, the market doesn't just become one area of a whole complex web of interaction within the social fabric. Instead, quote, economic or market rationale controls all conduct, unquote. It controls all conduct within the social fabric, for the market is the social fabric. Reterritorialization by the market, with the state as handmaiden, therefore, now involves breaking down the barriers between the market and all other zones of activity, such that the market becomes dispersed, flexible, and ubiquitous. Where pop culture enters into this equation is where the ubiquity of the market seeps into the private sphere and the fibers of every individual within the private sphere. Previously, the private sphere acted as a kind of protected site, protected from the logic of political economy. Currently, however, that sphere has now become yet another zone of the market axiomatic. This is made manifest by more activities that constitute social relations becoming inserted into the market for commercial gain. Think of cell phones that form the backbone of social connectivity across increasingly mobile individuals. Think of the proliferation of insurance products to cover more areas of life, from income to family to pets. And think of the proliferation of the commercial gym in place of communal sports, or what Arlie Hochschild calls the commercialization of intimate life, from the outsourcing of domestic chores in companies like Rent-A-Husband to the commercialization of prostitution and porn. Because this increasing commercialization of the social sphere is but an outworking and a reconfiguring of desire, its ubiquity means that even areas that are not up for exchange undergo a transformation as marketability, accumulation, enterprise, and profit become the dominant organizing narratives. If you do not believe me, look at WeFit. Thus far, we have looked at the way in which desire and the social fabric have, through the rubric of capitalism, has flattened a previously complex social texture and turned it into a smooth plane of market-based relations. What we have not done yet is establish the link between this total marketization and the totalization of warfare. This is what I'm going to do right now. It is asserted that the connective tissue to these marketized relations is the key to unlocking the bellicose streak that resides beneath the glistening windows and the smiles on the advertisements. The central process of capitalism's collapse of the sovereign into the market, and subsequently the market into the social sphere, is rationalization along market lines. And rationalization along market lines manifests itself in the process of commodification, or rendering of things into an object of exchange. Why pop culture fits into this process is because pop culture is the arena whereby all areas of life become pre-interpreted into an economic calculus where commodities are up for exchange. What is more, it is not just the things that are bought and sold that are treated as commodities for exchange. Even those outside the formal exchange process also undergo the same process of commodification, even if they are not put up for commercial exchange. Now, the first stage in commodification is the alienation of things from the original social and cultural nexus. It is a technique of commercialization, commodification is, and becomes necessary because you need to strip the thing of any meaning in order to turn it into a thing of exchange. Now, when the same calculus of ripping everything from their communal context and turning it into a means of exchange, when this same calculus becomes proliferated through the social sphere, it means that relations themselves become pre-interpreted and become similarly alienated from their social and communal context. This is because social relations are reduced to a state under the processes of commodification. Social relations are reduced to a state where communal relations are not the primary canvas of the social sphere. Rather, Bell argues that the capitalist axiomatic is one where individuals form the foundation of the social canvas, not communities. This is an important point. For desire that capitalism proliferates is the desire for liberty from all forms of control that do not first subject themselves to the individual will. In other words, social relations are the result of voluntary association rather than something that is born out of its coexistence with individuality. Thus, even social relations become so removed from their larger communal nexus that they are themselves stripped of their socially constituted meanings and become contracts between essentially monadic individuals. Two things are noteworthy about this contractualization of relations. The first is that they become the standardized type of relationship in both private and public spheres. Whether that relationship is getting a cup of coffee, to playing a game, to getting married, to becoming a citizen of a country, to voting for a party for an election, all of these, contract becomes the defining characteristic of that relationship. The complex texture of social relations at both the private and the public level becomes a single plane smoothened out by contract. And every form of social complexity that might act as a shelter from the processes of commodification become ironed out. The second thing to note is that this contractualization of relations is more than a mere reduction of social relations. Because as social relations become stripped into contracts, the nature of social relations actually changes. Bell writes that capitalist configurations of desire, when it dissolves all social relations into those of contract, actually veers social relations in a vector described as, quote, an agony of competition. In other words, when you have a social fabric where all relations are contractual, what you have is what is an unending agony of competition. As relations become contractualized, they simultaneously unleash within each individual an infinite desire for exclusive self-satisfaction, even if it must come at the expense of others. To put this in Augustinian terms, capitalism is the unleashing of the amor sui, the unleashing of the love of self. There is a proliferation of endless self-seeking desire throughout the entire social fabric, against which the divide between private and public is irrelevant. Also, there is a proliferation of competition of self-seeking desire as one self-maximizing individual with endless desire comes to see other self-maximizing individuals with endless desire as either a threat to remove or a potential resource to exploit. It's interesting, the economist Friedrich von Hayek once described us in this kind of social fabric as, quote, as impersonal means to our fellows, unquote. This is what our neighbors have become in Friedrich von Hayek's vision. In Augustinian terms, this is the amor sui giving way to the libido dominandi, giving way to the lust for domination. The ultimate result is a situation of constant competition in the social fabric. And what contracts end up becoming are sort of nodes whereby that competition comes to the fore in manageable form, rather as places whereby solidarity between neighbors is nurtured. The social fabric within pop culture thus becomes a series of nodes of conflict, albeit in sanitized form. Guns may be fired, provided they are mediated by a screen or a paintball suit. Knives may not cut flesh unless it is contractually entered into for the purposes of beautification in a plastic surgery, which in turn is fed back into the cycles of competition for attention on the dance floor or the beauty pageant. Now, because such contracts are entered into for profit, commerce becomes the vehicle for the deployment of conflict. Furthermore, even relations that are not subject to a formal commercialized contract have similarly become contractualized and commercialized. In the words of Friedrich von Hayek again, we approach our social relations by, quote, not treating one another as neighbors, but by applying in their interactions, rules of property and contract, unquote. Thus, even our relations that are intended for mutual upbringing become recalibrated along the lines of rivalry. Think of friendships, marriages, and families that are now measured and have policies devised on a cost-benefit analysis. Pop culture perpetuates networks of conflict, not only because they are contractual trades and commodities. The logic of commodification and the conflict that is built into these processes have now become so pervasive that even the narratives of solidarity, the stories that we trade in what brings us together, right, the stories that are communicated through such commodities, they are also similarly contractualized. Whether that solidarity is the love of a sexual hookup that in turn becomes cannibalistic in the Lady Gaga song Monster, whether that is in the advertised ideal of DKNY's depiction of a relationship based on the degree that one is, quote, delicious, the treatment of all relations as merely means to score points in the Xbox game Legend, the forging of a near familial solidarity in the context of setting your housemates up for eviction in Big Brother, the realization that all relations are merely occasions of death in the TV series Dexter, and so on. In Bell's words, social relations under capitalism are not only reduced, they are transformed into a kind of commercialized warfare. With capitalism ironing out the social fabric, the home front has now become an all-pervasive series of front lines. But going even further, yes, it does get worse. Going even further, the contractualization of relations is not the end point of the processes of capitalism's transformation of solidarity into bellicosity. It is only a step towards forms of collectivization by which whole classes of people are put into conflict with each other as either victims or victimizers. For the pop cultural contracts that have sanitized our conflicts on the home front are not isolated social nodes. They are forming a core that is nestled within networks of other conflicts that are not sanitized. Think of the hot zone conflicts in mineral-rich war zones, or the networks of slavery and human trafficking that are proliferated in much of the developing world that in turn feed the supply chains, be those supplies in labor or supplies in organs, that find their way into our batteries, our clothing, our jewelry, our audiovisual equipment, our phones, and our organ banks. Thus, every one of pop culture's trinkets is a point of sanitization of a very real trail of blood. Now that I've depressed you all, I need to conclude. So, let us turn back to Columbine. Because in obsessing about the depictions of war in any particular product, we ignore our complicity with the mechanisms that make that product available in the first place. Mechanisms which themselves are rooted in a war in peacetime. We have reason to agree with the theologian Graham Ward that life in our times in a way resembles the life of Patrick Bateman in Bret Ellis's book American Psycho. As Jeffrey Hunter has hinted in his comments about the book, capitalism has woven a layer of viciousness into a social fabric defined by the consumption of commodities to fulfill the endless desire that capitalism has unleashed. Capitalism's mix of the proliferation of infinite self-seeking desire, the contractualization of relations and commodification of everything and everyone has in turn generated the paradox whereby sociality in every part of the fabric is established on a foundation of warfare. Capitalism thereby forms the cultural backdrop against which the distinction between the home front and the front line has become disappeared in pop culture. As the trafficking in and consumption of commodities has become the privileged handmaiden. It is through pop culture that the libido dominandi and the amor sui have become channeled and dispersed, and it is through pop culture that public conflict has pierced the veil of the private. With varying degrees of subtlety, total war is now the defining totality of social relations. Now, is there a corrective? Bell suggests that there is. What Bell suggests as a corrective parallels Girard's notions of Christ's reconfiguring of desire, elaborated so well in Bernard Disco's presentation yesterday morning. Such a reform can only come about if the Christ, the Godhead who has dissociated himself from the cycle of violence and victimage, the Godhead who reveals our rivalry and all-encompassing victimage for what it is, and thus reforms that desire. It's not just an abstract, but a real encounter that is experienced in every node of the social fabric, so that in every exchange where there was rivalrous desire that in turn brings the front line into the home, the desire for self-giving, proceeding from a foundation of superabundance, can take its place and make each exchange a home once again, a home characterized by the refusal to submit to mimetic violence. How this takes place would have to be the subject of another paper, and indeed, questions can emerge as to whether the conditions for conversion actually can exist within the structures of pop culture itself. I suggest that it is, but that has to be for another paper. So let me just say that the reform of desire makes it necessary for Christ to really permeate space and time and challenge the spatial monopoly of capitalism and of pop culture. I thank you for your attention.
That was a talk by Dr. Matthew Tan. This talk was presented as part of a conference entitled Battling to the End, which was held at the Bildungszentrum Cardinal Dompner House in Freising, Germany. For more interviews, talks, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.